You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. I'm June Grosso. Every day we bring you insight and analysis into the most important legal news of the day. You can find more episodes of the Bloomberg Law Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts. The Democratic National Committee has sued Russia, the Trump campaign, and WikiLeaks, claiming widespread interference in the 2016 election as part of a, quote, brazen attack on American democracy. The lawsuit drew criticism even among Democrats, but DNC Chair Tom Perez, appearing on ABC's This Week yesterday, defended the suit and the timing of filing it.
In order to file a civil suit, you got to make sure you're filing it within the applicable statute of limitations. I don't know when Director Mueller's investigation is going to end, so we need to file now to protect our rights.
Joining me is David Glovin, Bloomberg News East Coast legal team leader. David, tell us more about the allegations in this 66-page complaint.
Sure. The DNC argues that the opening salvo on Russia's brazen attack on American democracy, that's the DNC's phrase, was a cyber attack on the DNC, according to the complaint, and it's mirroring allegations that have come up in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation and news reports. In 2015, 2016, Russian intelligence service hacked into the DNC's computers, penetrated its phone systems, exfiltrated tens of thousands of documents and emails, and then Russia used this stolen information to advance its own interests. And what the lawsuit claims and what others have said is that in the Trump campaign, Russia found a willing and active partner, that's a quote from the complaint, in disseminating information from the DNC servers.
So basically, it's information that's already been out there, nothing new. But could this mean that Trump staffers from the 2016 campaign will have to answer questions under oath about campaign activities? And then, unlike the Mueller probe, where we don't really know what they have for sure, that we'll hear that information?
Well, in addition to suing the Russian Federation and others in Russia, the lawsuit names the Trump campaign, the president, Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, Jared Kushner. So it is very likely that the DNC's lawyers, if they survive an eventual dismissal bid, will seek to question, to depose anyone and anything they can think of to learn what was going on.
So foreign governments are generally protected under this Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act from U.S. lawsuits. Is it likely that after, as you said, a motion dismissed, that Russia will be out of the suit?
Well, that's unclear. There is the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act that would protect a foreign country and agencies of the foreign country. There are exceptions to the rule, and the DNC is arguing that this case should be one such exception because it's a trespass on the computer servers. So that's something that'll be litigated, and the judge will eventually rule on.
And that computer element is why they say they had to file this within what's called the statute of limitations.
Right, right. I believe they said there was a 2-year statute of limitation from the hack or the first hack, and we were approaching that date.
So President Trump has threatened to countersue in tweets, saying, "We will now counter for the DNC server that they refused to give to the FBI." What is he referring to there exactly?
I think what the president was referring to is that the Trump campaign can just as the DNC can engage in discovery and question witnesses, the Trump campaign can do that as well, and that they plan to look into issues related to Hillary Clinton and other issues that would have us relitigating the 2016 election.
Yeah, it seems like this suit will be a lot of relitigating of different things that we've been talking about for the last couple of years. This lawsuit actually echoes a 1972 suit by the DNC. Tell me a little bit about that. Okay, it's a little bit. It's a little bit, right.
The DNC successfully sued after the Watergate break-in and did get a settlement. And that is one possibility here, of course. But more significant is that you will see the DNC seeking extensive discovery to find out who knew what and when.
And WikiLeaks has argued on its Twitter account that it's constitutionally protected from such suits. So we're going to see a lot of these arguments and talk about a motion to dismiss and how that may play into all this.
Sure. I mean, typically when a lawsuit is filed of this nature, the parties, even before discovery, will seek to dismiss on one ground or another. The Russian Federation, Russia, will seek to dismiss, citing the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. WikiLeaks might point to First Amendment protections, perhaps. I'm unclear as to what the Trump campaign would do. They may argue that there are facts insufficient for this case to go forward, even if accepted by the DNC, but they'll be wheeling at arguments in the weeks and months to come.
It seems as if there's enough here to get at least part of it through a motion to dismiss.
It's possible. It's certainly possible. Then you would see discovery. And as you see facts coming out from the special counsel or elsewhere, it could lead to an amended complaint and more allegations in the case and more claims. This could be around for a while.
It could be. And I think it would be refreshing to know what is actually being asked of people and what their answers are instead of hearing things, you know, secondhand and third hand from reporters.
Right. And that's one of the, for those who want these issues to be aired publicly, a civil lawsuit is typically in a public forum. So there are depositions might not be public when taken, but excerpts of the depositions can be included in exhibits. Of course, if it ever goes to trial, then that's all in public.
And we'll see how many years it takes to get to trial if it does. Thank you, David. That's David Glovin, Bloomberg News East Coast legal team leader. A record fine of $1 billion for Wells Fargo. The country's third largest bank has agreed to a settlement unprecedented in more ways than just the amount of the fine. Mick Mulvaney, who has been running the CFPB in addition to being Trump's budget director, explained that the settlement covers issues in Wells Fargo's auto lending and mortgage units.
The size of the fine is historic. It's $500 million OCC, $500 million to the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. But the violations here were historical. Keep in mind that by some counts, as many as 1 million consumers were impacted by just the two types of actions that were addressed in the consent order.
Joining me is Robert Hockett, a professor at Cornell Law School. Bob, this settlement also gives the OCC the right to remove some of Wells Fargo's executives or board members. How tough is this consent decree in relation to others?
Well, June, I think this actually sort of coheres with the others. It's quite consistent with them. In fact, you would almost think that it's all part of a sort of coordinated regulatory strategy among the various regulators who have jurisdiction over Wells Fargo. So as you know, back in February, when the Fed announced that it was going to place a ceiling on the asset growth of Wells until it sort of cleaned up its act, among the recommended cleanup actions were not only the putting into place of a better set of internal compliance procedures, but also the removal and replacement of several board members. So one might view the OCC's reference to this same possible remedy as, in effect, sort of echoing what the Fed has already strongly suggested. We might note also in this connection that it looks as though Wells has been thinking about retiring a few of those board members already, because several of them have been on the board for many years indeed.
So the settlement was the first enforcement action undertaken by the CFPB under the acting director Mulvaney, who, as we've discussed before, has been an opponent of the CFPB and hadn't announced any new enforcement action since he took over there. Does this ease the minds of consumer advocates about Mulvaney or not?
I sort of doubt that it will, although I'm sure that something like that might have been in the mind of Mr. Mulvaney when his bureau announced the particular sanction. The thing that's kind of puzzling about the sanction, I think, sort of explains why it is that some might be a little bit skeptical. So the first is there's absolutely no explanation given as to how that amount was reached or what connection it actually has to the actual losses that Wells is thought to have inflicted upon its own customers. The best estimates out there as to those losses are that they're much, much smaller than the fine itself. So I think some cynics or skeptics might think that this is sort of a political gesture designed on the one hand to kind of assuage the concerns of some who are concerned that Mr. Mulvaney is not a legitimate acting director of the CFPB. And second, it might also partly be designed to respond to Mr. Trump's tweet about Wells Fargo some weeks back. And indeed, a piece came out this weekend suggesting that that's exactly what was at work here.
Bob, there's also a departure from earlier CFPB practice in the consent order, which allows Wells Fargo to determine whether consumers suffered cognizable harm from the bank's activities. How will that affect the fine?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point. I mean, the nightmare scenario would be one where, you know, Wells purports to conduct a thorough investigation of the actual, say, pecuniary damages that were caused by its wrongs and arise at very minimal numbers. And then the CFPB says, all right, well, if you say so. I suspect that's not going to happen, however, given that Wells has faced a great deal, of course, of negative scrutiny over the last several years and is still in the doghouse, so to speak. It's also maybe worth noting that, you know, Wells benefited up to close to $4 billion under the new tax cuts from December. So it might actually view this particular fine as something eminently affordable, since it simply takes away about one quarter of the windfall that it received thanks to the new tax legislation that Trump was pushing back in December.
The chief financial officer said on April 13th that investigations are, quote, midway through. What other investigations are pending here?
Well, as you might recall, over the last several years, quite a few scandals have emerged. And one of the sort of meta scandals, you might say, that's sort of implicated by all of these scandals is that there's been inadequate sort of internal investigation within the massive and sprawling organization that is Wells Fargo itself into sort of what kinds of wrongs or abuses have been being committed, what kinds of harms have been being caused, who's been responsible, who's given the okay, and so forth. So in a sense, you know, as you and I have talked, of course, about some of the earlier Wells scandals, and in a couple of our earlier conversations, we were noting that, you know, more shoes are probably yet to drop. And I think that's still the case now. Basically, it's taking a long time, I think, to go through the massive volume of records of this institution to find out what all the wrongs have been and, again, what the harms are that have been caused, particularly the dollar amounts of those harms. And so I suspect we're still, you know, in kind of investigation mode, even internally at Wells, for some time to come.
In about a minute, Bob, what shoes are going to drop perhaps during the shareholder meeting tomorrow?
Oh my! Well, that should be interesting. So the couple things to note, maybe really quickly, since we only have a minute. You might recall that Wells's share price actually rose by a couple percent on Friday after the CFPB announcement. So it could be that some shareholders are thinking, "Oh boy, you know, so very glad we have this behind us. Now we have closure, and they won't be so upset." I suspect many, however, aren't going to be satisfied as of yet. They might indeed clamor for some of those board changes, and that would be an easy one for Wells to sort of comply with, because, again, they're already planning on doing that anyway with some of the longer-serving board members.
Well, we'll keep informed about that. I know that demonstrations are planned around the downtown Marriott in Des Moines, Iowa, where they're having the shareholders meeting. So perhaps we'll talk again on Wednesday, Bob. Thanks so much. That's Robert Hockett, professor at Cornell University Law School. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcast. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions.
alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.